Chapter 1. The Picture in the Bedroom. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. His parents called him Eustace Clarence, and masters called him Scrub. I can't tell you how his friends spoke to him, for he had none. He didn't call his father and mother father and mother, but Harold and Alberta. They were very up-to-date and advanced people. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, and teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes. In their house there was very little furniture, and very few clothes on beds, and the windows were always open. Eustace Clarence liked animals, especially beetles, if they were dead and pinned on a card. He liked books, if they were books of information, and had pictures of grain elevators, or of fat foreign children doing exercises in model schools. Eustace Clarence disliked his cousins, the four Pevenses, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. But he was quite glad when he heard that Edmund and Lucy were coming to stay, for deep down inside him he liked bossing and bullying. And though he was a puny little person who couldn't have stood up even to Lucy, let alone Edmund, in a fight, he knew that there are dozens of ways to give people a bad time if you are in your own home and they are only visitors. Edmund and Lucy did not at all want to come and stay with Uncle Harold and Aunt Alberta, but it really couldn't be helped. Father had got a job lecturing in America for 16 weeks that summer, and Mother was to go with him, because she hadn't had a real holiday for 10 years. Peter was working very hard for an exam, and he was to spend the holidays being coached by old Professor Kirk, in whose house these four children had had wonderful adventures long ago in the war years. If he had still been in that house, he would have had them all to stay. But he had somehow become poor since the old days, and was living in a small cottage with only one bedroom to spare. It would have cost too much money to take the other three all to America, and so only Susan had gone. Grown-ups thought her the pretty one of the family, and she was no good at schoolwork, though otherwise very old for her age. And Mother said she would get far more out of a trip to America than the youngsters. Edmund and Lucy tried not to grudge Susan her luck, but it was dreadful having to spend the summer holidays at their aunt's. "But it's far worse for me," said Edmund, "because at least you'll have a room of your own, and I shall have to share a bedroom with that record stinker Eustace." The story begins on an afternoon when Edmund and Lucy were stealing a few precious minutes alone together. And, of course, they were talking about Narnia, which was the name of their own private and secret country. Most of us, I suppose, have a secret country, but for most of us it is only an imaginary country. Edmund and Lucy were luckier than other people in that respect. Their secret country was real. They had already visited it twice, not in a game or a dream, but in reality. They had got there, of course, by magic, which is the only way of getting to Narnia, and a promise, or very nearly a promise, had been made them in Narnia itself that they would some day get back. You may imagine that they talked about it a good deal, when they got the chance. They were in Lucy's room, sitting on the edge of her bed and looking at a picture on the opposite wall. It was the only picture in the house that they liked. Aunt Alberta didn't like it at all. That was why it was put away in a little back room upstairs. But she couldn't get rid of it, because it had been a wedding present from someone she did not want to offend. It was a picture of a ship sailing straight towards you. Her prow was gilded and shaped like the head of a dragon with a wide-open mouth. She had only one mast and one large square sail, which was a rich purple. The sides of the ship, what you could see of them, where the gilded wings of the dragon ended, were green. She had just run up to the top of one glorious blue wave, and the nearest slope of that wave came down towards you, with streaks and bubbles on it. She was obviously running fast before a gay wind, listing over a little on her port side. By the way, if you are going to read this story at all, and if you don't know already, you had better get it into your head that the left of the ship, when you are looking ahead, is port, and the right is starboard. All the sunlight fell on her from that side, and the water on that side was full of greens and purples. On the other, it was darker blue from the shadow of the ship. "The question is," said Edmund, "whether it doesn't make things worse looking at a Narnian ship when you can't get there." "Even looking is better than nothing," said Lucy. "And she is such a very Narnian ship."
"Still playing your old game," said Eustace Clarence, who had been listening outside the door, and now came grinning into the room. Last year, when he had been staying with the Pevenses, he had managed to hear them all talking of Narnia, and he loved teasing them about it. He thought, of course, that they were making it all up, and as he was far too stupid to make anything up himself, he did not approve of that.
"You're not wanted here," said Edmund curtly. "I'm trying to think of a limerick," said Eustace. "Something like this. Some kids who played games about Narnia got gradually balmier and balmier."
"Well, Narnia and balmier don't rhyme, to begin with," said Lucy.
"It's an assonance," said Eustace.
"Don't ask him what an assy thingamy is," said Edmund. "He's only longing to be asked. Say nothing, and perhaps he'll go away." Most boys, on meeting a reception like this, would either have cleared out or flared up. Eustace did neither. He just hung about, grinning, and presently began talking again.
"Do you like that picture?" he asked.
"For heaven's sake, don't let him get started about art and all that," said Edmund hurriedly. But Lucy, who was very truthful, had already said,
"Yes, I do. I like it very much."
"It's a rotten picture," said Eustace.
"You won't see it if you step outside," said Edmund.
"Why do you like it?" said Eustace to Lucy.
"Well, for one thing," said Lucy, "I like it because the ship looks as if it were really moving, and the water looks as if it were really wet, and the waves look as if they were really going up and down."
Of course, Eustace knew lots of answers to this, but he didn't say anything. The reason was that at that very moment he looked at the waves and saw that they did look very much indeed as if they were going up and down. He had only once been in a ship, and then only as far as the Isle of Wight, and had been horribly seasick. The look of the waves in the picture made him feel sick again. He turned rather green and tried another look, and then all three children were staring with open mouths. What they were seeing may be hard to believe when you read it in print, but it was almost as hard to believe when you saw it happening. The things in the picture were moving. It didn't look at all like a cinema, either. The colours were too real and clean and out of doors for that. Down went the prow of the ship into the wave, and up went a great shock of spray. And then up went the wave behind her, and her stern and her deck became visible for the first time, and then disappeared as the next wave came to meet her and her bows went up again. At the same moment, an exercise book which had been lying beside Edmund on the bed flapped, rose, and sailed through the air to the wall behind him. And Lucy felt all her hair whipping round her face, as it does on a windy day. And this was a windy day. But the wind was blowing out of the picture towards them. And suddenly, with the wind, came the noises, the swishing of waves, and the slap of water against the ship's sides, and the creaking and the overall high, steady roar of air and water. But it was the smell, the wild, briny smell, which really convinced Lucy that she was not dreaming.
"Stop it!" came Eustace's voice, squeaky with fright and bad temper. "It's some silly trick you two are playing. Stop it! I'll tell Alberta! Ow!"
The other two were much more accustomed to adventures, but just exactly as Eustace Clarence said, "Ow!" they both said, "Ow!" too. The reason was that a great cold salt splash had broken right out of the frame, and they were breathless from the smack of it.
besides being wet through.
"I'll smash the rotten thing!" cried Eustace.
And then several things happened at the same time. Eustace rushed towards the picture. Edmund, who knew something about magic, sprang after him, warning him to look out and not to be a fool. Lucy grabbed at him from the other side and was dragged forward, and by this time either they had grown much smaller or the picture had grown bigger. Eustace jumped to try to pull it off the wall and found himself standing on the frame. In front of him was not glass, but real sea, and the wind and waves rushing up to the frame as they might to a rock. He lost his head and clutched at the other two who had jumped up beside him. There was a second of struggling and shouting, and just as they thought they had got their balance, a great blue roller surged up round them, swept them off their feet, and drew them down into the sea. Eustace's despairing cry suddenly ended as the water got into his mouth. Lucy thanked her stars that she'd worked hard at her swimming in the summer term. It is true that she would have gone on much better if she had used a slower stroke, and also that the water felt a great deal colder than it had looked while it was only a picture. Still, she kept her head and kicked her shoes off, as everyone ought to do who falls into deep water in their clothes. She even kept her mouth shut and her eyes open. They were still quite near the ship. She saw its green side towering high above them, and people looking at her from the deck. Then, as one might have expected, Eustace clutched at her in a panic, and down they both went. When they came up again, she saw a white figure diving off the ship's side. Edmund was close beside her now, treading water, and had caught the arms of the howling Eustace. Then someone else, whose face was vaguely familiar, slipped an arm under her from the other side. There was a lot of shouting going on from the ship, heads crowding together above the bulwarks, ropes being thrown. Edmund and the stranger were fastening ropes round her. After that followed what seemed a very long delay, during which her face got blue and her teeth began chattering. In reality, the delay was not very long. They were waiting till the moment when she could be got on board ship without being dashed against its side. Even with all their best endeavours, she had a bruised knee when she finally stood, dripping and shivering, on the deck. After her, Edmund was heaved up, and then the miserable Eustace. Last of all came the stranger, a golden-headed boy some years older than herself.
"Caspian!"
gasped Lucy as soon as she had breath enough. For Caspian it was. Caspian, the boy king of Narnia, whom they had helped to set on the throne during their last visit. Immediately Edmund recognised him too. All three shook hands and clapped one another on the back with great delight. "But who is your friend?" said Caspian almost at once, turning to Eustace with his cheerful smile. But Eustace was crying much harder than any boy of his age had a right to cry, when nothing worse than a wetting had happened to him, and would only yell out,
"Let me go! Let me go! I don't like it!"
"Let you go?" said Caspian.
"But where?"
Eustace rushed to the ship's side, as if he expected to see the picture frame hanging above the sea, and perhaps a glimpse of Lucy's bedroom. What he saw was blue waves flecked with foam, and paler blue sky, both spreading without a break to the horizon. Perhaps we can hardly blame him if his heart sank. He was promptly sick.
"Hey, Reinulf," said Caspian to one of the sailors, "bring spiced wine for their majesties. You'll need something to warm you after that dip."
He called Edmund and Lucy their majesties because they and Peter and Susan had all been kings and queens of Narnia long before his time. Narnia time flows differently from ours. If you spent 100 years in Narnia, you would still come back to our world at the very same hour of the very same day on which you left. And then, if you went back to Narnia after spending a week here, you might find that 1,000 Narnian years had passed. Or only a day. Or no time at all.
you never know till you get there. Consequently, when the Pevensey children had returned to Narnia last time for their second visit, it was, for the Narnians, as if King Arthur came back to Britain, as some people say he will, and I say the sooner the better. Reinulf returned with the spiced wine, steaming in a flagon, and four silver cups. It was just what one wanted, and as Lucy and Edmund sipped it, they could feel the warmth going right down to their toes. But Eustace made faces and spluttered and spat it out and was sick again and began to cry again and asked if they hadn't any plum trees vitamized nerve food and could it be made with distilled water, and anyway, he insisted on being put ashore at the next station. "This is a merry shipmate you've brought us, brother," whispered Caspian to Edmund with a chuckle. But before he could say anything more, Eustace burst out again.
"Oh, yeah! What on earth's that? Take it away! The horrid thing!"
He really had some excuse this time for feeling a little surprised. Something very curious indeed had come out of the cabin in the poop and was slowly approaching them. You might call it, and indeed it was, a mouse. But then it was a mouse on its hind legs, and stood about 2 feet high. A thin band of gold passed round its head, under one ear and over the other, and in this was stuck a long crimson feather. As the mouse's fur was very dark, almost black, the effect was bold and striking. Its left paw rested on the hilt of a sword, very nearly as long as its tail. Its balance, as it paced gravely along the swaying deck, was perfect, and its manners courtly. Lucy and Edmund recognized it at once. Reepicheep, the most valiant of all the talking beasts of Narnia, and the chief mouse. He had won undying glory in the Second Battle of Verona. Lucy longed, as she had always done, to take Reepicheep up in her arms and cuddle him. But this, as she well knew, was a pleasure she could never have. It would have offended him deeply. Instead, she went down on one knee to talk to him. Reepicheep put forward his left leg, drew back his right, bowed, kissed her hand, straightened himself, twirled his whiskers, and said, in his shrill, piping voice,
"My humble duty to your Majesty, and to King Edmund, too."
Here he bowed again.
"Nothing except your Majesty's presence was lacking to this glorious venture."
"Ugh! Take it away!" wailed Eustace. "I hate mice, and I never could bear performing animals. They're silly and vulgar and sentimental."
"Am I to understand," said Reepicheep to Lucy after a long stare at Eustace, "that this singularly discourteous person is under your Majesty's protection? Because, if not—"
At this moment Lucy and Edmund both sneezed.
"What a fool I am to keep you all standing here in your wet things," said Caspian. "Come on below and get changed. I'll give you my cabin, of course, Lucy, but I'm afraid we have no women's clothes on board. You'll have to make do with some of mine. Lead the way, Reepicheep, like a good fellow."
"To the convenience of a lady," said Reepicheep. "Even a question of honour must give way, at least for the moment."
And here he looked very hard at Eustace. But Caspian hustled them on, and in a few minutes Lucy found herself passing through the door into the stern cabin. She fell in love with it at once. The three square windows that looked out on the blue, swirling water astern, the low-cushioned benches round three sides of the table, the swinging silver lamp overhead. Dwarf's work, she knew at once, by its exquisite delicacy. And the flat, gold image of Aslan the lion on the forward wall above the door. All this she took in a flash, for Caspian immediately opened a door on the starboard side and said,
"This will be your room, Lucy. I'll just get some dry things for myself."
He was rummaging in one of the lockers while he spoke.
"And then leave you to change. If you'll fling your wet things outside the door, I'll get them taken to the galley to be dried."
Lucy found herself as much at home as if she'd been in Caspian's cabin for weeks, and the motion of the ship did not worry her, for in the old days, when she had been a queen in Narnia, she had done a good deal of voyaging. The cabin was very tiny, but bright with painted panels, all birds and beasts and crimson dragons and vines, and spotlessly clean. Caspian's clothes were too big for her, but she could manage. His shoes, sandals, and sea boots were hopelessly big, but she did not mind going barefoot on board ship. When she had finished dressing, she looked out of her window at the water rushing past and took a long, deep breath. She felt quite sure they were in for a lovely time. Chapter 2 On Board the Dawn Treader. "Ah, there you are, Lucy," said Caspian. "We were just waiting for you. This is my captain, the Lord Drinian." A dark-haired man went down on one knee and kissed her hand. The only others present were Weepycheep and Edmund. "Where is Eustace?" asked Lucy. "In bed," said Edmund. "And I don't think we can do anything for him. It only makes him worse if you try to be nice to him." "Meanwhile," said Caspian, "we want to talk." "By Jove, we do," said Edmund. "And first, about time. It's a year ago by our time since we left you just before your coronation. How long has it been in Narnia?"
"Exactly 3 years," said Caspian.
"All going well?" asked Edmund. "You don't suppose I've left my kingdom and put to sea unless all was well?" answered the king. "It couldn't be better. There's no trouble at all now between Telmarines, dwarfs, talking beasts, fauns, and the rest, and we gave those troublesome giants on the frontier such a good beating last summer that they pay us tribute now. And I had an excellent person to leave as regent while I'm away, Trumpkin the dwarf. You remember him?"
"Dear Trumpkin," said Lucy. "Of course I do. You couldn't have made a better choice."
"Loyal as a badger, ma'am, and valiant as a mouse," said Drinian.
He had been going to say, "as a lion," but had noticed Weepycheep's eyes fixed on him.
"And where are we heading for?" asked Edmund.
"Well," said Caspian, "that's rather a long story. Perhaps you remember that when I was a child, my usurping uncle, Miraz, got rid of 7 friends of my father's, who might have taken my part, by sending them off to explore the unknown eastern seas beyond the Lone Islands."
"Yes," said Lucy, "and none of them ever came back."
"Right. Well, on my coronation day, with Aslan's approval, I swore an oath that if once I established peace in Narnia, I would sail east myself for a year and a day to find my father's friends, or to learn of their deaths, and avenge them, if I could. These were their names: the Lord Revillian, the Lord Byrne, the Lord Argos, the Lord Mavramorn, the Lord Octesian, the Lord Restimar, and, oh, that other one who's so hard to remember."
"The Lord Roop, sire," said Drinian.
"Roop, Roop, of course," said Caspian. "That is my main intention, but Reepycheep here has an even higher hope."
Everyone's eyes turned to the mouse.
"As high as my spirit," he said, "though perhaps as small as my stature. Why should we not come to the very eastern end of the world? And what might we find there? I expect to find Aslan's own country. It is always from the east, across the sea, that the great lion comes to us."
"I say, that is an idea," said Edmund in an awed voice.
"But do you think," said Lucy, "Aslan's country would be that sort of country? I mean, the sort you could ever sail to?" "I do not know, madam," said Weepycheep. "But there is this. When I was in my cradle, a wood woman, a dryad, spoke this verse over me. Where sky and water meet, where the waves grow sweet, Doubt not, Reepy Cheep, to find all you seek. There is the utter east.
I do not know what it means, but the spell of it has been on me all my life.
After a short silence, Lucy asked,
And where are we now, Caspian?
The captain can tell you better than I, said Caspian.
So Drinian got out his chart and spread it on the table.
That's our position, he said, laying his finger on it. Or was at noon today. We had a fair wind from Caer Parabel, and stood a little north for Galma, which we made on the next day. We were in port for a week, for the Duke of Galma made a great tournament for his majesty, and there he unhorsed many knights.
And got a few nasty falls myself, Drinian. Some of the bruises are still there, put in Caspian.
And unhorsed many knights, repeated Drinian with a grin. We thought the Duke would have been pleased if the King's Majesty would have married his daughter, but nothing came of that.
Squints and has freckles, said Caspian.
Oh, poor girl, said Lucy.
And we sailed from Galma, continued Drinian, and ran into a calm for the best part of 2 days, and had to row, and then had wind again, and did not make Terebinthia till the 4th day from Galma. And there the king sent out a warning not to land, for there was sickness in Terebinthia, but we doubled the cape and put in at a little creek far from the city, and watered. Then we had to lie off for 3 days before we got a southeast wind and stood out for 7 isles. The 3rd day out, a pirate, Terebinthian by her rig, overhauled us. But when she saw us well armed, she stood off after some shooting of arrows on either part.
And we ought to have given her chase and boarded her, and hanged every mother's son of them, said Reepy Cheep.
And in 5 days more we were in sight of Mule, which, as you know, is the westernmost of the 7 isles. Then we rode through the straits and came about sundown into Redhaven on the Isle of Bren, where we were very lovingly feasted, and had victuals and water at will. We left Redhaven 6 days ago, and have made marvellously good speed, so that I hope to see the Lone Islands the day after tomorrow. The sum is, we are now nearly 30 days at sea, and have sailed more than 400 leagues from Narnia.
"And after the Lone Islands?" said Lucy.
"No one knows, Your Majesty," answered Drinian, "unless the Lone Islanders themselves can tell us."
"They couldn't in our days," said Edmund.
"Then," said Reepy Cheep, "it is after the Lone Islands that the adventure really begins."
Caspian now suggested that they might like to be shown over the ship before supper, but Lucy's conscience smote her, and she said,
"I think I really must go and see Eustace. Seasickness is horrid, you know. If I had my old cordial with me, I could cure him."
"But you have," said Caspian. "I'd quite forgotten about it. As you left it behind, I thought it might be regarded as one of the royal treasures, and so I brought it. If you think it ought to be wasted on a thing like seasickness."
"It'll only take a drop," said Lucy.
Caspian opened one of the lockers beneath the bench, and brought out the beautiful little diamond flask which Lucy remembered so well.
"Take back your own, Queen," he said.
They then left the cabin and went out into the sunshine. In the deck there were 2 large, long hatches, fore and aft of the mast, and both open, as they always were in fair weather, to let light and air into the belly of the ship. Caspian led them down a ladder into the after hatch. Here they found themselves in a place where benches for rowing ran from side to side, and the light came in through the oar holes and danced on the roof. Of course, Caspian's ship was not that horrible thing, a galley rowed by slaves. Oars were used only when wind failed, or for getting in and out of harbour, and everyone, except Reepy Cheep, whose legs were too short, had often taken a turn. At each side of the ship the space under the benches was left clear for the rowers' feet, but all down the centre there was a kind of pit which went down to the very keel, and this was filled with all kinds of things, sacks of flour, casks of water and beer, barrels of pork, jars of honey, skin bottles of wine, apples, nuts, cheese, biscuits, turnips, sides of bacon. From the roof, that is, from the underside of the deck, hung hams and strings of onions, and also the men of the watch off duty in their hammocks. Caspian led them aft, stepping from bench to bench. At least, it was stepping for him, and something between a step and a jump for Lucy, and a real long jump for Reepicheep. In this way they came to a partition with a door in it. Caspian opened the door, and led them into a cabin which filled the stern underneath the deck cabins in the poop. It was, of course, not so nice. It was very low, and the sides sloped together as they went down so that there was hardly any floor. And though it had windows of thick glass, they were not made to open because they were under water. In fact, at this very moment as the ship pitched, they were alternately golden with sunlight and dim green with the sea. "You and I must lodge here, Edmund," said Caspian. "We'll leave your kinsmen the bunk and sling hammocks for ourselves."
"I beseech your Majesty," said Drinian.
"No, no, shipmate," said Caspian. "We have argued all that out already. You and Rince was the mate, are sailing the ship, and will have cares and labours many a night when we are singing catches or telling stories, so you and he must have the port cabin above. King Edmund and I can lie very snug here below. But how is the stranger?"
Eustace, very green in the face, scowled, and asked whether there was any sign of the storm getting less. But Caspian said, "What storm?" And Drinian burst out laughing.
"Storm, young master," he roared. "This is as fair weather as a man could ask for."
"Who's that?" said Eustace irritably. "Send him away. His voice goes through my head."
"I've brought you something that will make you feel better, Eustace," said Lucy.
"Oh, go away and leave me alone," growled Eustace.
But he took a drop from her flask, and though he said it was beastly stuff, the smell in the cabin when she opened it was delicious. It is certain that his face came the right colour a few moments after he had swallowed it, and it must have felt better, because instead of wailing about the storm in his head, he began demanding to be put ashore, and said that at the first port he would lodge a disposition against them all with the British consul. But when Reepicheep asked what a disposition was, and how you lodged it, Reepicheep thought it was some new way of arranging a single combat. Eustace could only reply,
"Fancy not knowing that!"
In the end, they succeeded in convincing Eustace that they were already sailing as fast as they could towards the nearest land they knew, and that they had no more power of sending him back to Cambridge, which was where Uncle Harold lived, than of sending him to the moon. After that, he sulkily agreed to put on the fresh clothes which had been put out for him and come on deck. Caspian now showed them over the ship, though indeed they had seen most of it already. They went up onto the forecastle and saw the lookout man standing on a little shelf inside the gilded dragon's neck and peering through its open mouth. Inside the forecastle was the galley, or ship's kitchen, and quarters for such people as the boatswain, the carpenter, the cook, and the master archer. If you think it odd to have the galley in the bows, and imagine the smoke from its chimneys streaming back over the ship, that is because you are thinking of steamships, where there is always a headwind. On a sailing ship, the wind is coming from behind, and anything smelly is put as far forward as possible. They were taken up to the fighting top, and at first it was rather alarming to rock to and fro there and see the deck looking small and far away beneath. You realized that if you fell, there was no particular reason why you should fall on board rather than in the sea. Then they were taken to the poop, where Rince was on duty with another man at the great tiller, and behind that the dragon's tail rose up, covered with gilding, and round inside it ran a little bench. The name of the ship was Dawn Treader,
she was only a little bit of a thing compared to one of our ships, or even with the cogs, dromons, carracks, and galleons which Narnia had owned when Lucy and Edmund had reigned there under Peter as the High King, for nearly all navigation had died out in the reigns of Caspian's ancestors. When his uncle, Miraz, the usurper, had sent the Seven Lords to sea, they had had to buy a Galmian ship and man it with hired Galmian sailors. But now Caspian had begun to teach the Narnians to be seafaring folk once more, and the Dawn Treader was the finest ship he had built yet. She was so small that forward of the mast there was hardly any deck room between the central hatch and the ship's boat on one side, and the hen coop, Lucy fed the hens, on the other. But she was a beauty of her kind, a lady, as sailors say, her lines perfect, her colours pure, and every spar and rope and pin lovingly made. Eustace, of course, would be pleased with nothing, and kept on boasting about liners and motorboats and aeroplanes and submarines. "As if he knew anything about them," muttered Edmund. But the other two were delighted with the Dawn Treader, and when they returned aft to the cabin and supper, and saw the whole western sky lit up with an immense crimson sunset, and felt the quiver of the ship, and tasted the salt on their lips, and thought of unknown lands on the eastern rim of the world, Lucy felt that she was almost too happy to speak. What Eustace thought had best be told in his own words, for when they all got their clothes back, dried, next morning, he at once got out a little black notebook and a pencil and started to keep a diary. He always had this notebook with him, and kept a record of his marks in it, for though he didn't care much about any subject for its own sake, he cared a great deal about marks, and would even go to people and say, "I got so much, what did you get?" But as he didn't seem likely to get many marks on the Dawn Treader, he now started a diary. This was the first entry. August 7th. Have now been 24 hours on this ghastly boat, if it isn't a dream. All the time a frightful storm has been raging. It's a good thing I'm not seasick. Huge waves keep coming in over the front, and I've seen the boat nearly go under any number of times. All the others pretend to take no notice of this, either from swank, or because Harold says one of the most cowardly things ordinary people do is to shut their eyes to facts. It's madness to come out into the sea in a rotten little thing like this, not much bigger than a lifeboat, and, of course, absolutely primitive indoors. No proper saloon, no radio, no bathrooms, no deck chairs. I was dragged all over it yesterday evening, and it would make anyone sick to hear Caspian showing off his funny little toy boat as if it was the Queen Mary. I tried to tell him what real ships are like, but he's too dense. E and L, of course, didn't back me up. I suppose a kid like L doesn't realise the danger, and E is buttering up C, as everyone does here. They call him a king. I said I was a Republican, but he had to ask me what that meant. He doesn't seem to know anything at all. Needless to say, I've been put in the worst cabin of the boat, a perfect dungeon, and Lucy has been given a whole room on deck to herself. Almost a nice room, compared with the rest of this place. C says that's because she's a girl. I tried to make him see what Alberta says, that all that sort of thing is really lowering girls. But he was too dense. Still, he might see that I shall be ill if I'm kept in that hole any longer. E says we mustn't grumble, because C is sharing it with us himself to make room for L, as if that didn't make it more crowded and far worse. Nearly forgot to say that there is also a kind of mouse thing that gives everyone the most frightful cheek. The others can put up with it if they like, but I shall twist his tail pretty soon if he tries it on me. The food is frightful, too. The trouble between Eustace and Reepicheep arrived even sooner than might have been expected. Before dinner the next day, when the others were sitting round the table waiting, being at sea gives one a magnificent appetite, Eustace came rushing in, wringing his hands, and shouting out, "That little brute has half killed me!
I insist on it being kept under control. I could bring an action against you, Caspian. I could order you to have it destroyed.
At the same moment, Reepicheep appeared. His sword was drawn, and his whiskers looked very fierce. But he was as polite as ever.
"I ask your pardons all," he said, "and especially Her Majesty's. If I had known that he would take refuge here, I would have awaited a more reasonable time for his correction."
"What on earth's up?" asked Edmund.
What had really happened was this. Reepicheep, who never felt that the ship was getting on fast enough, loved to sit on the bulwarks far forwards, just beside the dragon's head, gazing out at the eastern horizon, and singing softly in his little chirruping voice the song the dryad had made for him. He never held on to anything, however the ship pitched, and kept his balance with perfect ease. Perhaps his long tail, hanging down to the deck inside the bulwarks, made this easier. Everyone on board was familiar with this habit, and the sailors liked it, because when one was on lookout duty, it gave one somebody to talk to. Why exactly Eustace had slipped and reeled and stumbled all the way forward to the forecastle, he had not yet got his sea legs, I never heard. Perhaps he hoped he would see land, or perhaps he wanted to hang about the galley and scrounge something. Anyway, as soon as he saw that long tail hanging down, and perhaps it was rather tempting, he thought it would be delightful to catch hold of it, swing Reepicheep round by it once or twice upside down, then run away and laugh. At first the plan seemed to work beautifully. The mouse was not much heavier than a very large cat. Eustace had him off the rail in a trice, and very silly he looked, thought Eustace, with his little limbs all splayed out and his mouth open. But unfortunately Reepicheep, who had fought for his life many a time, never lost his head even for a moment, nor his skill. It is not very easy to draw one's sword when one is swinging round in the air by one's tail, but he did, and the next thing Eustace knew was two agonizing jabs in his hand which made him let go of the tail, and the next thing after that was that the mouse had picked itself up again as if it were a ball bouncing off the deck, and there it was, facing him, and a horrid, long, bright, sharp thing like a skewer was waving to and fro within an inch of his stomach. This doesn't count as below the belt for mice in Narnia, because they can hardly be expected to reach higher.
"Stop it!" spluttered Eustace. "Go away! Put that thing away! It's not safe! Stop it, I say! I'll tell Caspian! I'll have you muzzled and tied up!"
"Why do you not draw your own sword, poltroon?" cheeped the mouse. "Draw and fight, or I'll beat you black and blue with the flat."
"I haven't got one," said Eustace. "I'm a pacifist. I don't believe in fighting."
"Do I understand?" said Reepicheep, withdrawing his sword for a moment and speaking very sternly. "That you do not intend to give me satisfaction?"
"I don't know what you mean," said Eustace, nursing his hand. "If you don't know how to take a joke, I shan't bother my head about you."
"Then take that," said Reepicheep, "and that, to teach you manners and the respect due to a knight and a mouse and a mouse's tail."
And at each word he gave Eustace a blow with the side of his rapier, which was thin, fine, dwarf-tempered steel and as supple and effective as a birch rod. Eustace, of course, was at a school where they didn't have corporal punishment, so the sensation was quite new to him. That was why, in spite of having no sea legs, it took him less than a minute to get off that forecastle and cover the whole length of the deck and burst in at the cabin door, still hotly pursued by Reepicheep. Indeed, it seemed to Eustace that the rapier, as well as the pursuit, was hot. It might have been red-hot by the feel. There was not much difficulty in settling the matter once Eustace realized that everyone took the idea of a duel seriously, and heard Caspian offering to lend him a sword, and Drinian and Edmund discussing whether he ought to be handicapped in some way to make up for his being so much bigger than Reepicheep. He apologized, sulkily,
and went off with Lucy to have his hand bathed and bandaged, and then went to his bunk. He was careful to lie on his side.
Chapter 3. The Lone Islands.
"Land in sight!"
shouted the man in the bows. Lucy, who had been talking to Rince on the poop, came pattering down the ladder and raced forward. As she went, she was joined by Edmund, and they found Caspian, Drinian, and Weepycheep already on the forecastle. It was a coldish morning, the sky very pale, and the sea very dark blue with little white caps of foam, and there, a little way off on the starboard bow, was the nearest of the lone islands, Felimath, like a low green hill in the sea, and behind it, further off, the grey slopes of its sister, Dourne.
"Same old Felimath! Same old Dourne!" said Lucy, clapping her hands. "Oh, Edmund, how long is it since you and I saw them last?"
"I've never understood why they belong to Narnia," said Caspian. "Did Peter the High King conquer them?"
"Oh, no," said Edmund. "They were Narnian before our time, in the days of the White Witch."
"By the way, I have never yet heard how these remote islands became attached to the crown of Narnia. If I ever do, and if the story is at all interesting, I may put it in some other book."
"Are we to put in here, sire?"
asked Drinian.
"I shouldn't think it would be much good landing on Felimath," said Edmund. "It was almost uninhabited in our days, and it looks as if it is the same still. The people live mostly on Dourne, and a little on Avra, that's the third one. You can't see it yet. They only keep sheep on Felimath."
"Then we'll have to double that cape, I suppose," said Drinian, "and land on Dourne. That'll mean rowing."
"I'm sorry we're not landing on Felimath," said Lucy. "I'd like to walk there again. It was so lonely. A nice kind of loneliness. And all grass and clover and soft sea air."
"I'd love to stretch my legs, too," said Caspian. "I tell you what, why shouldn't we go ashore in the boat and send it back, and then we could walk across Felimath and let the Dawn Treader pick us up on the other side?"
If Caspian had been as experienced then as he became later on in this voyage, he would not have made this suggestion. But at the moment it seemed an excellent one.
"Oh, do let's," said Lucy.
"You'll come, will you?" said Caspian to Eustace, who had come on deck with his hand bandaged.
"Anything to get off this blasted boat," said Eustace.
"Blasted?" said Drinian. "How do you mean?"
"In a civilized country, like where I come from," said Eustace, "the ships are so big that when you're inside you wouldn't know you were at sea at all."
"In that case, you might just as well stay ashore," said Caspian. "Will you tell them to lower the boat, Drinian?" The king, the mouse, the two Pevenses, and Eustace all got into the boat and were pulled to the beach of Felimath. When the boat had left them and was being rowed back, they all turned and looked round. They were surprised at how small the Dawn Treader looked. Lucy was, of course, barefoot, having kicked off her shoes while swimming, but that is no hardship if one is going to walk on downy turf. It was delightful to be ashore again, and to smell the earth and grass, even if at first the ground seemed to be pitching up and down like a ship, as it usually does for a while if one has been at sea. It was much warmer here than it had been on board, and Lucy found the sand pleasant to her feet as they crossed it. There was a lark singing. They struck inland and up a fairly steep, though low, hill. At the top, of course, they looked back, and there was the Dawn Treader, shining like a great bright insect, and crawling slowly northwestward with her oars. Then they went over the ridge and could see her no longer. Dourne now lay before them, divided from Felimath by a channel about a mile wide. Behind it and to the left lay Avra. The little white town of Narrow Haven on Dourne was easily seen.
"Hello! What's this?"
said Edmund suddenly. In the green valley to which they were descending, six or seven rough-looking men, all armed, were sitting by a tree.
"Don't tell them who we are," said Caspian.
"And pray, Your Majesty, why not?"
said Weepy-Cheep, who had consented to ride on Lucy's shoulder.
"It just occurred to me," replied Caspian, "that no one here can have heard from Narnia for a long time. It's just possible they may not still acknowledge our overlordship, in which case it might not be quite safe to be known as the king."
"We have our sword, sire," said Weepy-Cheep.
"Yes, Reep, I know we have," said Caspian. "But if it is a question of reconquering the three islands, I'd prefer to come back with a rather larger army."
By this time they were quite close to the strangers, one of whom, a big, black-haired fellow, shouted out,
"A good morning to you."
"And a good morning to you," said Caspian. "Is there still a governor of the Lone Islands?"
To be sure there is," said the man. "Governor Gumpus. His sufficiency is at Narrow Haven. But you'll stay and drink with us?"
Caspian thanked him, though neither he nor the others much liked the look of their new acquaintance, and all of them sat down. But hardly had they raised their cups to their lips when the black-haired man nodded to his companions, and, as quick as lightning, all the five visitors found themselves wrapped in strong arms. There was a moment's struggle, but all the advantages were on one side, and soon everyone was disarmed and had their hands tied behind their backs, except Weepy-Cheep, writhing in his captor's grip and biting furiously.
"Careful with that beast, Tax," said the leader. "Don't damage him. He'll fetch the best price of the lot, I shouldn't wonder."
"Coward! Poltroon!" squeaked Weepy-Cheep. "Give me my sword and free my paws if you dare!"
"Oof!"
whistled the slave merchant, for that is what he was.
"It can talk! Well, I never did. Blowed if I take less than 200 crescents for him."
The Calamen crescent, which is the chief coin in those parts, is worth about a third of a pound.
"So that's what you are," said Caspian. "A kidnapper and slaver. I hope you're proud of it."
"Now, now, now, now," said the slaver. "Don't you start any jaw. The easier you take it, the pleasanter all round, see? I don't do this for fun. I've got my living to make, same as everyone else."
"Where will you take us?"
asked Lucy, getting the words out with some difficulty.
"Over to Narrowhaven," said the slaver. "For market day tomorrow."
"Is there a British consul there?" asked Eustace.
"Is there a witch?"
said the man. But long before Eustace was tired of trying to explain, the slaver simply said,
"Well, I've had enough of this jabber. The mouse is a fair treat, but this one will talk the iron leg of a donkey. Off we go, mates."
Then the four human prisoners were roped together, not cruelly, but securely, and made to march down to the shore. Reepy-Cheep was carried. He had stopped biting on a threat of having his mouth tied up. But he had a great deal to say, and Lucy really wondered how any man could bear to have the things said to him which were said to the slave dealer by the mouse. But the slave dealer, far from objecting, only said,
"Go on,"
whenever Reepy-Cheep paused for breath, occasionally adding,
"It's as good as a play," or, "Blimey, you can't help almost thinking it knows what it's saying," or, "Was it one of you what trained it?"
This so infuriated Weepy-Cheep that in the end the number of things he thought of saying all at once nearly suffocated him, and he became silent. When they got down to the shore that looked towards Dorne, they found a little village, and a longboat on the beach, and lying a little further out, a dirty, bedraggled-looking ship.
"Now, youngsters," said the slave dealer, "let's have no fuss, and then you'll have nothing to cry about. All aboard!"
At that moment, a fine-looking bearded man came out of one of the houses, an inn, I think, and said,
"Well, Pug, more of your usual wares?"
The slaver, whose name seemed to be Pug, bowed very low and said in a wheedling kind of voice,
"Yes, if it please your lordship."
"How much do you want for that boy?" asked the other, pointing to Caspian.
"Ah," said Pug, "I knew your lordship would pick on the best. No deceiving your lordship with anything second-rate. That boy now, I've taken a fancy to him myself. Got kind of fond of him, I have. I'm that tender-hearted. I didn't ever ought to have taken up this job. Still, to a customer like your lordship." "Tell me your price, Carrion," said the lord sternly. "Do you think I want to listen to the rigmarole of your filthy trade?"
300 crescents, my lord, to your honourable lordship, but to anyone else, I'll give you 150.
"Oh, please, please," broke in Lucy, "don't separate us, whatever you do. You don't know—"
But then she stopped, for she saw that Caspian didn't even now want to be known.
150, then," said the lord. "As for you, little maiden, I am sorry I cannot buy you all. Unrope my boy, Pug, and look, treat these others well while they are in your hands, or it'll be the worse for you."
"Well," said Pug, "no ever heard of a gentleman in my way of business who treated his stock better than what I do. Well, why, I treat 'em like my own children."
"That's likely enough to be true," said the other grimly. The dreadful moment had now come. Caspian was untied, and his new master said,
"This way, lad."
And Lucy burst into tears, and Edmund looked very blank. But Caspian looked over his shoulder and said, "Cheer up. I'm sure it will come all right in the end. So long."
"Now, missy," said Pug, "don't you start taking on and spoiling your looks for the market tomorrow. You be a good girl, and then you won't have nothing to cry about. See?"
Then they were rowed out to the slave ship, and taken below into a long, rather dark place, none too clean, where they found many other unfortunate prisoners. For Pug was, of course, a pirate, and had just returned from cruising among the islands and capturing what he could. The children didn't meet anyone whom they knew. The prisoners were mostly Galmians and Terebinthians. And there they sat in the straw and wondered what was happening to Caspian, and tried to stop Eustace talking as if everyone except himself was to blame. Meanwhile, Caspian was having a much more interesting time. The man who had bought him led him down a little lane between two of the village houses, and so out into an open place behind the village. Then he turned and faced him.
"You needn't be afraid of me, boy," he said. "I'll treat you well. I bought you for your face. You reminded me of someone."
"May I ask of whom, my lord?" said Caspian.
"You remind me of my master, King Caspian of Narnia."
Then Caspian decided to risk everything on one stroke.
"My lord," he said, "I am your master. I am Caspian, King of Narnia."
"You make very free," said the other. "How shall I know this is true?"
"Firstly, by my face," said Caspian. "Secondly, because I know within 6 guesses who you are. You are one of those 7 lords of Narnia whom my uncle Miraz sent to sea, and whom I have come out to look for. Argos, Bairn, Octesian, Restimar, Mavrimorn, or, I've forgotten the others. And, finally, if your lordship will give me a sword, I will prove on any man's body in clean battle that I am Caspian, the son of Caspian, lawful king of Narnia, lord of Caer Paravel, and emperor of the Lone Islands."
"By heaven!" exclaimed the man. "It is his father's very voice and trick of speech. My liege, your majesty."
And there, in the field, he knelt and kissed the king's hand.
"'The monies your lordship dispersed for our person "'will be made good from our treasury,' said Caspian.
"'They are not in Pug's purse yet, sire,' said the Lord Byrne, "'for he it was. "'And never will be, I trust. "'I have moved his sufficiency, the governor, 100 times "'to crush this vile traffic in man's flesh.'
"'My Lord Byrne,' said Caspian, "'we must talk of the state of these islands, "'but first, what is your lordship's own story?'
"'Short enough, sire,' said Byrne. "'I came thus far with my 6 fellows, "'loved a girl of the islands, "'and felt I had had enough of the sea. "'And there was no purpose in returning to Narnia "'while your Majesty's uncle held the reins, "'so I married, and have lived here ever since.'
"'And what is this governor, this Gumpas like? Does he still acknowledge the King of Narnia for his lord?
In words, yes. All is done in the king's name. But he would not be best pleased to find a real live King of Narnia coming in upon him. And if your majesty came before him alone and unarmed, well, he would not deny his allegiance, but he will pretend to disbelieve you. Your grace's life would be in danger. "'What following has your majesty in these waters?'
"'There is my ship, just rounding the point,' said Caspian. "'We are about 30 swords, if it came to fighting. "'Shall we not have my ship in, and fall upon Pug, "'and free my friends whom he holds captive?'
"'Not by my counsel,' said Byrne. "'As soon as there was a fight, 2 or 3 ships would put out from Narrowhaven to rescue Pug.' "'Your Majesty must work by a show of more power than you really have, "'and by the terror of the king's name. "'It must not come to plain battle. "'Gumpus is a chicken-hearted man and can be overawed.'
"'After a little more conversation, Caspian and Byrne walked down to the coast, "'a little west of the village, and there Caspian winded his horn. "'This was not the great magic horn of Narnia, Queen Susan's horn.' He had left that at home for his regent Trumpkin to use if any great need fell upon the land in the king's absence. Grinion, who was on the lookout for a signal, recognized the royal horn at once, and the Dawn Treader began standing in to the shore. Then the boat put off again, and in a few moments Caspian and the Lord Byrne were on deck, explaining the situation to Grinion.
He, just like Caspian, wanted to lay the Dawn Treader alongside the slave ship at once and board her, but Byrne made the same objection.
"'Steer straight down this channel, Captain,' said Byrne, "'and then round to Avra, where my own estates are. "'But first, run up the king's banner, hang out all the shields, "'and send as many men to the fighting top as you can. "'And about 5 bowshots hence, when you get open sea on your port bow, "'run up a few signals.'
"'Signals? To whom?' said Drinian.
"'Why, to all the other ships we haven't got, "'but which it might be well that Gumpus thinks we have.'
"'Oh, I see,' said Grinion, rubbing his hands. "'And they'll read our signals. "'What shall I say? "'Whole fleet round the south of Avra, and assemble at—'
"'Burnstead,' said the Lord Byrne. "'That'll do excellently. "'Their whole journey, if there were any ships—' would be out of sight from Narrowhaven. Caspian was sorry for the others, languishing in the hold of Pug's slave ship, but he could not help finding the rest of that day enjoyable. Late in the afternoon, for they had to do all by oar, having turned to starboard round the northeast end of Dwyrn, and port again round the point of Avra, they entered into a good harbour on Avra's southern shore, where Byrne's pleasant land sloped down to the water's edge. Byrne's people, many of whom they saw working in the fields, were all freemen, and it was a happy and prosperous fief. Here they all went ashore, and were royally feasted in a low pillared house overlooking the bay. Byrne and his gracious wife and merry daughters made them good cheer. But after dark, Byrne sent a messenger over by boat to Dwyrn, to order some preparations, he did not say exactly what, for the following day.